want you to turn again to Luke's Gospel and chapter 21. We've come this morning to verse 37. We've been reading through Luke's Gospel together. And if you've been with us, you'll know that we've come to an absolutely crucial point in the story. We followed the story of Jesus right from the beginning when he was born in Bethlehem. We caught a glimpse of his childhood. Even at the age of 12, he knew that God was his father, that he was God's son. We saw him at the age of 30 going to the River Jordan to be baptized by his cousin John. It was then, when he was coming up out of the water, that the Spirit came upon him from heaven, and he knew he'd been anointed to be the Saviour King, that he was the Messiah. We watched as he began traveling around Galilee, preaching the good news of the kingdom and doing the signs of the kingdom, great miracles. Everywhere he went, he proclaimed the same message, that the kingdom of God had arrived on earth, that he himself was the chosen king, and that the way into God's kingdom was by trusting him. And then we saw him setting off to travel to Jerusalem, the capital city of Israel. We've watched his journey to Jerusalem. We've watched the journey become a royal procession with an army of followers marching behind him. And then we saw Jesus ride into Jerusalem on a royal mount, a colt on which no man had ever sat before. And we heard the people chanting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And we saw Jesus accepting, welcoming their acclamation. Jesus has arrived in Jerusalem. He's arrived as the rightful King, claiming the kingdom for himself. Jesus strides into the temple, the center of national life. He begins to act with kingly authority. He begins to drive out all the corrupt businessmen who have set up their stalls in the temple. He denounces the official leaders of the nation, the priests, the lawyers, and the rulers. He calls them thieves. And Jesus takes over the temple. He takes it over for his own purposes. He begins to teach in the temple. The crowds gather around him to listen to him. And when the leaders question him, "By what authority are you doing these things?" Jesus makes the answer absolutely clear. He does them because he's the Son of God. He does them because he's the promised cornerstone of the nation. He does them because he's the Messiah. He won't say, "I am the Messiah." But everything he does proclaims the fact that he is the Messiah. The atmosphere there must have been electric. Remember, this was just a few days before the Feast of the Passover. The biggest, the most emotionally weighted occasion in the Jewish year. This was the festival at which they celebrated their freedom from slavery in Egypt. And hundreds of thousands of Jewish people would travel from all over the world to worship in Jerusalem. And the great thing that united all those hundreds of thousands of people was that they were all dreaming of a day when the nation would be free from all its enemies. The Passover was the feast of liberation. and they were all longing for liberation. And here in their midst is the man who claims to be their rightful king, the ultimate king, the king who's destined to overthrow all other kingdoms, the king who claims that he will rule forever. And this king has already done amazing miracles. He's healed the sick. He's cast out demons. He's raised the dead. And here he is in the capital city, in the temple, acting, speaking as the king, the great liberator. That's the point we're at in the story. Now this morning, I want you to put yourself into the position of the Jewish leaders, the priests, the rulers, the teachers, the people who have controlled the life of the nation for so long. Yes, the Romans are officially in power. Judea's part of the Roman Empire. But the fact is that the Romans are willing to delegate, to devolve authority to these Jewish leaders. It's the Jewish leaders who run so much of what goes on from day to day. What are they going to do now, faced with this situation where Jesus is teaching day by day in their temple, acting as the king in their midst, surrounded by crowds of cheering, shouting people? What are they going to do? They've really, I suppose, got three options. Option number one, they could simply surrender. They could humble themselves. They could surrender to King Jesus. They could confess the truth that they've been wicked, greedy men who have abused their power for their own ends. They could accept that what Jesus has said about them is true. And they could come and fall at the feet of Jesus. They could acknowledge that Jesus is the true king. They could beg him for mercy. And they would receive mercy at his hand. They could trust themselves to him. They're not even considering that option. For them, it's unthinkable. Oh, if they did come and fall at the feet of Jesus, Jesus would welcome them. He'd forgive them. He'd save them. He'll do it for any sinner, great or small. He's the friend of sinners. Whether the sinners are people in high places or whether the sinners are the dregs of society, Jesus is the friend of sinners. If they come to him and if they fall before him and ask for mercy, he'll give it to them. But for them, no, that's unthinkable. To humble themselves in front of a carpenter from Nazareth, to lose their power, their status, their self-esteem, to confess that they've been wrong all down the line, to put themselves on the same level as the prostitutes and the tax collectors who have come and asked Jesus for mercy, to give up the sins that have made them rich and powerful. No, no, it's unthinkable. It doesn't matter to them what miracles Jesus has done. It doesn't matter if God has used him to raise the dead. These men are determined that they will never surrender to Jesus. If that thought ever entered their mind, they push it away with all their might. They find ways of explaining away everything, of explaining away the miracles, or just shutting them out from their thoughts. Their hearts and their minds are absolutely shut against Jesus. A second option. They could do nothing. at least for the moment. They could just stand back and hope that the storm blows over. Most of the pilgrims who are there in Jerusalem will go home once the Passover feast is over. And the crowds, well, they'll lose interest, won't they, once the novelty of Jesus' preaching has worn off. Maybe Jesus and his disciples will go back to Galilee, where he can be forgotten about or dealt with quietly. And if he ever were to try and come back to Jerusalem, well, they'll be better prepared next time. They'll never let things reach this point again. They could do that. Just hold back. But it would be a very high-risk strategy. Firstly, because they don't know what Jesus is intending. What if Jesus is preparing right now to raise his standard and to start a revolt against the Romans? If he's planning to do that, then Passover week is the perfect time to do it. He's only got to stand in the temple and shout once, "Follow me!" And he'll have tens of thousands of men seizing whatever weapons they can get their hands on, ready to storm Herod's palace, ready to throw down the fortress where the Roman troops are quartered. You could have Jerusalem ablaze with revolution in half an hour. And if that happens, then one of two things will follow. Scenario one, the Romans will crush the revolt. And they'll execute Jesus. And they'll savagely punish Jesus' followers. But for the Jewish leaders, it would be too late. Because the Romans would certainly blame them for letting the situation develop. And the Romans will dissolve the Jewish parliament. And they'll impose direct rule, just as the Brits did in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. These Jewish leaders would lose their position, their power, possibly their lives. Or scenario two, Jesus and the rebels could win. They could slaughter the Roman garrison. They could drive the Romans out of Jerusalem. Jesus could be reigning this time next week. And where would that leave these Jewish leaders? The quislings who have worked with the Romans. Somewhere in the dungeons or hanging from a scaffold. Of course, it's highly unlikely that the Romans would accept defeat. In the end, they'd strike back with all the resources of the empire. The Romans had never finally been defeated anywhere in the world. But for these Jewish leaders, it would be too late, even if the Romans regained the upper hand. Of course, the Jewish leaders have got no evidence that Jesus is planning a revolt. So far, all he's done is preach and teach. But even if he isn't, in the atmosphere that's being generated there in Jerusalem, the crowds could spontaneously erupt into revolution. They could crown Jesus whether he's asked for it or not. It would only take the slightest spark for the powder keg of Jerusalem to explode. And if they do nothing at this stage, it could even be seen that they are silently supporting Jesus' claims. The fact that they've taken no action against him for vandalizing the temple. The fact that they've not stopped him from teaching there every day under their nose. The crowds could take that as them giving Jesus the stamp of their approval. If these leaders just leave things alone, they could find that their names are being used to incite the revolution. The risk is too high. They've got to do something. So that leaves option three. They've got to neutralize Jesus once and for all. And there's only one way they can do that. He's got to die. And that's the decision they take. We read about it back in chapter 19, verse 47. The chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him. They've got no option left. If they won't surrender to him, then they've got to kill him. But it's not straightforward, is it? How do they go about it? Well, they could just arrange to have him murdered. Perhaps, let's say, poisoned. He's often eating and drinking in public. Couldn't someone just pass him a poisoned cup or piece of fruit? That was the way the Roman emperors got rid of quite a lot of dangerous people. Smeared poison on a piece of fruit. Well, what if it goes wrong? What if the murder is botched? Or what if it's traced back to them? I mean, Jesus is incredibly popular with the crowds. If these leaders try to have him murdered and it's ever traced back to them, well, their credibility is shot. They themselves could be lynched by an angry crowd. Murder isn't really an option. They need to go down a legal road. They need to get Jesus executed. But that's not straightforward either, because they've got no authority to execute anyone. That's one legal power that the Romans have never devolved to them. The Romans guarded the right of execution very carefully. And the Romans tend to be very fussy about legalities. They're not going to execute Jesus on the say-so of the Jewish leaders unless he can be shown to have broken some Roman law. And he hasn't. And a more basic problem even than that for these leaders, how do they get hold of Jesus? He's got the crowds around him all the time. And the crowds will jump to his defence. Any attempt to arrest Jesus might itself spark the revolution that they're terrified of. And even if they do succeed in arresting Jesus, they've then got the wrath of the crowds to cope with. The crowds could be marching on the high priest's palace to demand his release. So, obvious answer, Jesus' enemies have got to arrest him when he doesn't have crowds of people around him. But that's not as easy as it sounds. Why not? Well, because he's got crowds around him all day long. And the authorities don't know where to find him at night. Look at chapter 21, verse 37. And you'll see the problem that the authorities have. Every day, it says, he was teaching in the temple. He's there all day. He's there from sun up to sundown. He doesn't leave till nightfall. It says at night he went out and lodged on the mount called Olivet. And then we read, and early in the morning, all the people came to him in the temple to hear him. So he's back there in the temple, first thing in the morning, and the crowds are already there, wanting to listen to him. Imagine it. The crowds are packed around Jesus in the temple courts. They've been there all day. And now it's getting dark. And Jesus says to the crowds, well, that's enough for today, I must leave you now. And he gets up, he begins to move towards the gate of the temple. What happens? The crowds get up and they move with him. He walks through the gates and the crowds are still there with him. He walks through the streets of the city, they're still there. There are literally tens of thousands of people moving through the streets together. Some of them are staying in the city. Some of them, many of the pilgrims, are lodging in villages and farms all around Jerusalem. Many of them will be sleeping in tents or out in the open. Jesus isn't going to be alone when he walks out of Jerusalem and takes the road up to the Mount of Olives Jesus and his disciples, yes, they're lodging somewhere on the Mount of Olives, we're told. But so are hundreds, maybe thousands of others. And they're walking along there in the darkness because Jesus doesn't leave the temple until nightfall. Yeah, that crowd breaks up eventually as people branch off towards their different campsites. But in the darkness, who can tell who's who? Who knows which of the shadowy figures slipping away in the darkness is Jesus? And it's the same in the morning. Tens of thousands of people walking through the darkness to get to the temple at daybreak. When Jesus walks into the temple, he's already got people all around him. And it sounds easy, doesn't it? Just arrest the man! But it's not easy at all. And for the authorities, time was running out. That's the point that's made at the beginning of chapter 22. Verse 1, now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called the Passover. A Passover night, and then a festival week known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. If the situation is going to explode, it's going to explode during that week. So these Jewish leaders are desperate now. They've got to arrest Jesus before Passover. Otherwise, it could be too late. But how? They simply can't see a way. The chief priests and the scribes were seeking how they were going to put Jesus to death, for they feared the people. Luke says they were seeking a way. You can imagine the desperate discussions going on in the corridors of power. Well, couldn't we do this? No, that's too risky. Well, could we try this? No, that would never work. Well, haven't our spies come up with anything? Can't they find out where he's staying at night? Well, apparently he chooses a different place each night. Well, can't he be followed? Well, we've tried. And he always slips off in the darkness. And after all, he wears just the same clothes, the same hood as everyone else does. These leaders must have been so frustrated. And then suddenly there's a breakthrough. From their point of view, a marvellous, unexpected solution. There's a man asking to see them. And he says he can help them with some information. He's brought to them. His name is Judas. Judas Iscariot. Haven't we seen you before? I expect so. You'll have seen me with Jesus. I'm one of his followers. I'm one of his inner circle. He trusts me. I hear you've got a problem. I think I can help. And so they negotiate. And they come to an agreement. Judas will wait for a moment when Jesus is away from the crowds. And then he'll find some way of tipping them off. And they'll pay him for betraying Jesus. Verse 5 we read, they were glad and agreed to give him money. So he consented and sought an opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of a crowd. How utterly despicable. Judas has promised to lie, to dissemble, to pretend to be Jesus' friend still. And meanwhile, he's going to watch him every moment, just waiting for a moment to betray his friend, the man he called his master. Jesus has admitted Judas into his inmost counsels. He's treated him as one of his dearest companions. And Judas is going to watch him in order to stab him in the back. Luke simply says Satan entered into Judas. If he hadn't been a man given over to Satan, he couldn't have done it. I guess sometime over the next few weeks we're going to have to talk about Judas and how Judas came to this point where Satan could just take hold of him like that. How he could become just a tool of Satan. It's a grim, grim story, isn't it? That a person who once said and meant it, I'm going to follow Jesus. That a man who was once attracted to Jesus, who once followed Jesus, how that man became a tool of Satan. I'm going to have to ask the question, how could it happen? But that's not for this morning. This morning it's these Jewish leaders I'm concentrating on. And all it says about them is, they were glad. I'm sure they were. From their point of view, what a turn up for the books this was. Just when they'd reached the point of despair, one of Jesus's inner circle turns up on the doorstep without them having pushed for it, without them having planned it. If they'd spent months trying to turn Judas around, they'd be shouting for glee that they had succeeded. But they've not had to. The initiative was all on Judas's side. They hadn't gone to him. He's come to them out of the blue. I'm sure that some of them saw this as God's intervention. They'll have spoken about it as a wonderful providence. Remember, they were genuinely religious men among the teachers and the rulers of Israel. Men like Gamaliel. Men like Saul of Tarsus. Whatever he was a devoted man. A man who really believed in God. He was one of the young rulers of Israel. One of the scribes. Men like that firmly believed that they were doing God's work. All right, their minds were twisted, corrupted by sin. But they believed that they were serving God. Well, from their point of view, surely this was God stepping in to turn the situation round, to rescue them, to rescue Israel from the damage that Jesus could do. Jesus is on the point of causing the Romans to come down on them, to turn Jerusalem into a bloodbath. But now, God has stepped in. This is God's solution. And the fact that the solution was that they would pay a man to lie and to cheat and to betray, well, that didn't matter. If you believe that God is guiding you, if you believe that God has given you a sign, well, that justifies whatever you do, doesn't it? What a warning we've got here. You know, there are Christians who are always looking out for signs to guide them. And if something happens in a striking, providential way, if, let's say, there's some astonishing coincidence, if there's some amazing event that happens at exactly the crucial moment, then they take it that must be God's guidance for them. You know, Christian biographies are full of these things. And I was reading autobiography this past week by a missionary who shall remain nameless. But she was talking about how she and her colleagues were debating whether they ought to build a house of prayer, a holy tower to which they could retreat to pray. And part of the reasoning was that Hindu people around couldn't understand why they had no holy place, why these Christians had no holy place like the holy places of the Hindus. So they asked for guidance. Should they build such a place? And then just at the crucial moment, the one architect whom they would have wanted to design the building for them contacted them to say he was in the area. He lived thousands of miles away, but he suddenly turned up on the doorstep and said he'd like to visit them. Well, how could we doubt after that? The timing of his visit meant it must be a sign from God. Well, I'm not commenting on whether it was a good thing to build the house of prayer or not. What I do know is that these Jewish leaders could have argued in exactly the same way. It's no coincidence that Judah should have turned up at this moment offering his help. This has to be God guiding us. Let me read to you a few paragraphs from Alan Bullock's huge biography of Adolf Hitler. He tells the story of the plot against Hitler's life, which was organised by a group of army officers. The assassin was to be a man called von Stauffenberg. He brought his papers with him to a meeting with Hitler and Hitler's senior officers. He brought his papers with him in a briefcase in which he had concealed a bomb fitted with a device for exploding it 10 minutes after the mechanism had been started. The conference was already proceeding when von Stauffenberg joined the group of officers round a large, heavy oak table on which were spread out a number of maps. The Führer himself was standing towards the middle of one of the long sides of the table, constantly leaning over the table to look at the maps. Von Stauffenberg placed his briefcase under the table, having started the fuse before he came in, and then left the room unobtrusively on the excuse of a telephone call to Berlin. He had been gone only a minute or two when a loud explosion shattered the room, blowing out the walls and the roof and setting fire to the debris, which crashed down on those inside. Von Stauffenberg was sure that Hitler was dead. He couldn't possibly have survived. In the smoke and confusion, with guards rushing up and the injured men inside crying for help, Hitler staggered out of the door covered in dust. His hair was scorched, his right arm hung stiff and useless, one of his legs had been burned, a falling beam had bruised his back, and both eardrums were found to be damaged by the explosion, but he was alive. Those who had been at the end of the table where von Stauffenberg placed the briefcase were either dead or badly wounded. Hitler had been protected, partly by the tabletop over which he was leaning at the time, and partly by the heavy wooden support on which the table rested, and against which Stauffenberg's briefcase had been pushed before the bomb exploded. Somebody in the room had pushed the assassin's briefcase away from where he had left it, pushed it against a heavy wooden support, which then shielded Hitler from the blast. Although badly shaken, Hitler was curiously calm, and in the early afternoon he appeared on the station platform to receive Mussolini. Apart from a stiff right arm, he bore no traces of his experience, and the account which he gave to Mussolini was marked by its restraint. As soon as they reached his headquarters, Hitler took Mussolini to look at the wrecked conference room. Then, as he began to reenact the scene, his voice became more excited. After my miraculous escape from death today, I am more than ever convinced that it is my fate to bring our common enterprise to a successful conclusion. Nodding his head, Mussolini could only agree. After what I have seen here, I am absolutely of your opinion. This was a sign from heaven. And Hitler's declaration again and again in the days that followed was that he had been chosen by Providence to make history, and those who thwarted him would be destroyed. He knew it because of the wonderful Providence that had protected him. The fact is that all sorts of amazing things happen. Things that may seem utterly miraculous. Things that by their exact timing, seem to be pushing us in a particular direction. Those things happen. They happen to believers and they happen to unbelievers. And yes, we can say that ultimately it's God who brings them about. Clearly, Hitler survived because God planned the turn of events. We believe that, don't we? Judas turned up at that moment because God had ordained that he would turn up at that moment. But the fact that such providences happen must never be taken as guidance about what it is right to do. It could not be right for these Jewish leaders to pay a man to lie. It could not be right for them to plan the murder of an innocent man, even if he is no more than a man. As I say, the books you'll read, Christian books, so often would make you believe that the way to be guided is by looking out for remarkable providences, striking coincidence, wonderful timings. And when you read those books and when you read about these amazing events, it is so easy to be overawed by them. Not indications of what God wants a man or a woman to do. We are guided by the law of God. Well, Judas had committed himself. Now he had to find the right time. A time when Jesus could be arrested without crowds around him. And the ideal opportunity lay ahead. The Passover feast, the special once-a-year meal eaten late in the evening after nightfall by each Jewish family. It had to be eaten in Jerusalem. That was the law. So Judas knew that Jesus wouldn't be camping out on the Mount of Olives that night. He would have to be in Jerusalem. And the Passover meal was a private meal. It was always eaten by a family or a household privately behind closed doors. So there's going to be no crowds around when Jesus eats the Passover meal. If Judas can find out where Jesus and his family, his disciples, are going to eat the Passover meal, and then if he can let the authorities know, that will be their perfect opportunity to arrest Jesus. But Jesus doesn't let Judas know. In fact, he doesn't let any of the disciples know where the meal's to be held. Jesus makes the arrangements himself, and he makes them privately. He arranges with a householder in Jerusalem to borrow, for that night, a large upstairs room from him. He asks the householder to lay out furnishings, table, couches for the meal. He tells the householder that he will send two of his disciples on the day to prepare the meal in that room. And he tells the householder exactly how and where he's to meet the two disciples. The two disciples won't come to his home. Jesus tells them of a meeting place, a rendezvous point. Well, verse 7, then came the day of unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So, and Jesus had chosen the two disciples he was going to send, Peter and John. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat it." But he doesn't give them an address. So they ask him, "Well, where would you have us prepare it?" And he tells them what he's arranged. "Behold, when you've entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you." They didn't know that. They weren't told the name of the man. They were just told that he would find them, he would meet them. And they'd know it was the right man because he'd be carrying a water pot. That would mark him out. It was usually a woman's job. And they must follow that man, follow him into the house that he enters. And then tell the master of the house, the teacher says to you, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? That's the password. That's the agreed signal to the household, and they must speak to him with exactly those words. And then he'll show you a large upper room furnished. Prepare it there. And they went, and they found it just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. Do you see what Jesus has done? Do you see how careful he's been? Apart from Peter and John, none of the other disciples are involved at all. And even Peter and John don't know the address of the place. They don't know the name of the host. So they can't let it slip, even by accident. There's no way that that information can get to Judas. Peter and John can go there, they can prepare the food, and then Jesus himself can take the other 10 disciples there after dark. And they won't know where they're going until they arrive. There'll be no opportunity for Judas to pass on this information to the authorities. You see, Jesus knew. He knew that one of the disciples was a traitor, a mole. And he knew which of them it was. And he knew exactly what Judas had done and what Judas was planning to do. There was no way Judas could keep things secret from God's Son. Hence these elaborate preparations. Now, two why questions. The first why didn't Jesus expose Judas as the thief, the liar that he was? Why didn't Jesus expel him from the circle of the disciples before Judas could betray him? Answer, because Jesus knew that this was God's plan. He knew that God had ordained that he, the innocent one, would be betrayed by one of his friends, that his heart would be broken by one of his closest companions. Jesus knew he had to die by the cunning of the priests and the rulers. He knew he had to die at the cruel hands of the Romans. He knew he had to die betrayed by Judas Iscariot. It was God's plan, and he willingly submitted to it. It was the price that had to be paid for sinners to be saved, for the world to be redeemed. For you or me to be restored, to be saved. But then the second why is this. If Jesus knew that Judas was going to betray him, if he knew that this was God's plan, why did he take such elaborate precautions to stop Judas from knowing where the meal was to be held? What was gained by keeping it a secret from Judas? And the answer to that is this. Jesus knew that God his Father hadn't just planned that Judas would betray him. He knew that his Father had planned the exact moment when it would happen. And God had planned that Jesus must not be arrested until he had sat down and had this meal with his disciples. God had planned it. And Jesus wanted it. Look at verse 14. When the hour came, he reclined at table and the apostles with him, and he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. I've wanted so much to have this special meal with you. You're my own family, my household. I've wanted it so much, says Jesus. I'm going to suffer. Knows that death is very close now. But I wanted to eat with you, just you, before I suffer. These days have been such frantic days for Jesus, with the crowds around him all the time. Maybe it had been many days since it had been just Jesus and his disciples round a meal table talking together. And Jesus desperately wanted this one last farewell meal with them. It was at this meal that he was going to give them bread to eat and wine to drink, which would help them remember him through all the dark days ahead. It was at this meal that he would teach them things that would enable them to stand through every crisis. And it was at this meal that he would simply have the opportunity to be with them, to show his love for them, to hear them say one last time before he died that they loved him. He longed for this meal, and he wasn't going to let Judas spoil it for him. Judas was allowed to start the meal with them, but by the end of the meal he'd gone. He'd gone on his way to betray Jesus. That was the plan. At the end, it was just Jesus and the 11 who truly loved him, sharing the Last Supper together. That's why Judas had to be prevented from betraying the location, because Jesus longed to have this meal, and it mustn't be interrupted. Two things to say before we close. Number one, how carefully Jesus planned this last meal. That's what we've seen, isn't it? How carefully he planned to make sure that he had that time and that it wasn't going to be interrupted. How carefully he planned that he and his disciples would be together. Jesus knew it was God's plan. But that didn't mean that Jesus could stand back and say, well, God will make sure it happens. Jesus planned carefully, meticulously, covered every base, prepared for every eventuality. The fact that it was God's plan didn't mean that Jesus didn't have to plan. I think we need to learn from Jesus' example. Too often, Christians fall into a sloppy mindset where they think they don't need to plan things. They'll just leave it to God to work things out. Well, we'll just see what happens when we get there. God will provide. Well, Jesus didn't think like that. He made sure that a room was booked and that it was appropriately furnished and that two men were allocated to prepare the food and that precautions were taken to make sure they got there safely and then to make sure that the meal wasn't interrupted. Jesus planned ahead, and we need to learn to plan. Okay, our plans aren't infallible. God can always overrule them and change them. But still, we plan. We take precautions. If a thing is worth doing, it's worth planning. God makes his plans from eternity. Jesus made his plans. And we've got to learn from him to be faithful planners. There are many things that won't happen unless we do plan them. That applies to everyday activities. And it applies especially to our walk with God. If I don't plan to read the Bible, it won't happen. I have to have a fixed time, a fixed place, a schedule, a plan. Otherwise, it will just be pushed out. If I don't plan to pray, it won't happen. It'll always be crowded out by other pressing duties. If I don't plan to be at meetings, if you don't plan to be at meetings, Lord's Day meetings, Wednesday evening meetings, it won't happen. Something will always come along. Some people are planners by nature. They're natural organisers. Some people aren't. But if we are to be followers of Jesus, we have to make plans as Jesus made plans. And then the second thing is this. How much Jesus desired this last meal. The meal that was to be the Last Supper. The meal that became what we call the Lord's Supper. It was obviously so important to him, or he wouldn't have gone to such lengths to make sure it happened. Those of you who are disciples of the Lord Jesus, let me ask you, how important is the Lord's Supper to you? Is it important enough for you to do the sort of planning that Jesus had to do to make sure that he could be there with his disciples? For some of you, to be at the Lord's Supper regularly, it would mean the most careful, disciplined planning. It would mean reshuffling maybe your whole schedule. Well, Jesus planned because he thought it was vitally important that he and his disciples should be there together for this meal. And he wanted it. He said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you. Could you truthfully say to Jesus, and I've eagerly desired to eat your supper with you, Lord Jesus. Oh, I look forward to it so much. You know, if we love the Lord Jesus, we will look forward with such eagerness to sitting down with him at his table, to be there in that private setting where the world is shut out, where it's just Jesus and his family together, where we can talk together so freely, where we can eat together so intimately, where we can tell him that we love him, where we hear him say to us that he loves us. Jesus loved the Last Supper. Oh, he says, I wanted it so much. He was willing to do the work among the crowds. Oh, he was doing the Father's work. But this was what he looked forward to, sitting down with his disciples. Are we planning? Are we planning all our duties, all the work that we have to do as parents, as husbands, as wives, as Bible readers, as prayers, as church members? Are we planning this, to have time and space to sit with Jesus at his table?